This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Well, thank you for coming tonight. Actually, this is a really important week for tattoo history, not only for the event tonight and this wonderful exhibition, but last night in Paris at the Quai Branly Museum, the Ethnographic Museum in downtown Paris, there was a really incredible tattoo exhibition, one of the largest ones in recent decades, called Tattoo Tattooist, that opened. It's a very large exhibition. It talks about the history of indigenous tattooing as well as the contemporary renaissance in tattooing. And it's actually going to stay up for over a year and a half. That's how dedicated the museum is to showing and telling the history of tattooing. But it also helps that the director has a giant Japanese back piece on his back. So I think that's one of the main interests why it's going to run so long. But it's a very exciting time for people that are interested in tattoo history. I'll give you a little bit of a really brief biographical sort of statement, because many people ask me, how did you get involved with, you know, studying the subject? And, you know, like all graduate students in search of a thesis project, I was looking for one when I was at the University of Alaska Fairbanks doing my master's study. And I guess maybe it's fate, but I was there for 1 week, and I walked across campus and came across a tattooed Inupiat elder that had chin tattoos. And I was really intrigued by that because I didn't know anything about tattooing at that time. I didn't have any tattoos myself. And I was really sort of fascinated by that. And so I started digging deeper and found out that basically every people across the circumpolar north had some form of tattooing practice. And this woman actually was not tattooed in the traditional manner by an elder. She actually had it done with a machine, with a tattooist in a tattoo shop. But she wanted to pay homage to her elders and those cultural practices that identified them. So I did a little more investigating, and I found out there was a small speck of an island in the Bering Strait called St. Lawrence Island that actually had about a dozen elderly women who continued to hold traditional skin stitch tattoos, so facial embroidery, bodily embroidery tattoos on themselves. And I was really intrigued by that, so I sought permission to study their life stories and their biographies of tattooing for my master's thesis. And that was in the mid-90s. And sadly, by 2005, the last two women had passed away, and so two did a tradition that was 2,200 years old on that island. And sadly, also in the Canadian Arctic, the last Inuit woman with traditional skin stitch tattoos passed away in 2010. But luckily, thank goodness, it took a generation, but now the younger generations are beginning to bring it back, and there's a lot of interest now in these indigenous tattoos. So people are bringing it back to life. I guess this lecture is really sort of a general encyclopedic sort of exploration into indigenous tattooing across the tribal world. It's sort of accentuated with videos from the Tattoo Hunter series as well as a couple of other pieces of archival footage, just to give you a sense of, you know, maybe the feelings, the experiences that people underwent receiving traditionally hand-tapped tattoos, also skin-stitch tattoos. I'm going to cover all the techniques that were practiced in the indigenous world, and I'm also going to start off sort of with a timeline of history, beginning with the earliest evidence of tattooing, which many people don't know. And I just learned last night when I was reading an article in The Guardian about the Quai Branly exhibition, they also didn't get it right, which is unfortunate. But anyway, they got the second oldest evidence, and they thought it was the oldest. But anyway, so can anybody guess what continent the oldest evidence we have for tattooing comes from? Any guesses? No, somebody said Australia, but I know you couldn't hear him. Nope. A lot of scarification in Australia, but skin pigmentation is very dark there, so tattoos didn't show up so well. That's why scarification was de rigueur. Actually, it comes from South America. And at least one 7,000-year-old male mummy of the prehistoric Chinchota culture had a tattooed mustache on his upper lip. So the earliest evidence we actually have is cosmetic. But the second oldest evidence we have of tattooing also comes from a mummy. And the famous European iceman Ötzi, who was discovered in the Otzel Alps in 1991. And what's really intriguing about his tattoos, and which I'm always intrigued, buys, whenever I see very small tattoos on people, sometimes I find those, the stories behind those, to be much more fascinating than these really beautiful ones that embellish the human body. But he has approximately 57 linear tattoos on his body. There's one that's cruciform. And remarkably, it has been shown, I don't want to go into too many details about it, that perhaps 85 to 95% of these line up with classical acupuncture points to relieve rheumatism in the joints. So we think that this is the oldest evidence of therapeutic tattooing. And this theme of therapeutic joint tattooing is found across the indigenous world. I continue to find it. I found it in Papua New Guinea last year. But on St. Lawrence Island, where I worked for my master's thesis, there was also a form of joint tattooing related to this therapy. And then, again, I forgot about this example. This so-called Pazark chief, so a Scytho-Siberian people that were roaming the Siberian steppes 2,500 years ago, again, he had these really beautiful geometric tattoos, but I was always very intrigued by these dot-like motifs found on his back, on his ankle. And I was aligning those, when I was conducting my master's research thesis, with similar joint tattoos that were placed on the bodies of men and women after they had served as a pallbearer in a funeral, or after they had made their first kill, either a polar bear, a seal, or a walrus, or they'd struck a whale for the first time. And what I was trying to figure out is, for one, okay, I saw these sort of overlying possibilities with acupuncture and joint remedies, but on St. Lawrence Island, they gave me a different explanation. They did say that if they did mark those spots, they could receive severe rheumatic complaints, and ultimately those limbs would wither up and they would be severely debilitated and perhaps die. But their reasoning behind it was that they believed that each joint was a passageway into one of their multiple souls. So they believed in multiple souls that embodied and lived within these primary joint articulations. So they used an apotropaic substance, or an evil repelling mixture of, it's a tattoo pigment, to shut down those passageways into the body. And this mixture was soot, seal oil, graphite, and urine. And mixing those together created this magical tattoo pigment that they believed would shut down these passageways in the body so that evil spirits couldn't hitch a ride and cause harm. And I'm wondering if perhaps maybe the Pazark chief that I just showed you, perhaps they had similar concepts, because this concept of sort of limb souls, if you will, is very common throughout the indigenous world. Also, across the circumpolar north, there's other facial tattoos. Again, I'm really interested in these dot-like motifs. I'm not going to go into the other symbolism on women's faces or the marks that are across that man's nose on an ancient ivory figurine from the old Bering Sea culture. But again, these dot-like motifs that are found in mummies in Greenland and 2,000-year-old ancient ivory figurines from Bering Strait, specifically St. Lawrence Island, again, those line up with classical acupuncture points to remedy facial paralysis, eye complaints, and whatnot. And we know ethnographically that men that were interviewed around 1900 in Bering Strait specifically stated that forms of tattoo on the face were used to relieve those precise maladies that I just spoke about. So again, whenever, if you're out there traveling and you see small tattoos, sometimes it's interesting or it's a good idea to ask questions about them, because there could be a lot of information behind those tattoos and most people just don't think about it. Again, recently when I was in Sarawak, which is Malaysian Borneo, I've been there before in 2002, and I'm actually going to show you some footage of that, I found a clan that continues to practice medicinal forms of tattooing, again, for joint pains, sprains in the ankle, the fingers. And again, if you remember that earlier slide of Utsi the Iceman, he actually had two parallel bands of tattooing around one of his wrists like a bracelet, which in some sense is fairly similar to this man who has a bracelet tattoo. So I see that there's a continuation of these sort of joint tattooing therapeutics that have gone on for over five millennia. And I'm just intrigued by things like that. But the Kayan also used to practice this really amazing and intricate form of body tattooing that was related to increased fertility in women. So these are bamboo shoot tattoos that were believed to increase their fertility. And also many of these apotropaic motifs that were believed to repel evil spirits encountered in the jungle. So a lot of these tattoos were related to their religious concepts, and it was intertwined into just about everything they did. These same motifs were also incorporated into basketry designs, to mat designs, to ikat weaving, to clothing that they wore. And there are other tattoos, like right here in this woman, this Kayan woman. These two bands that are not tattooed, it was believed if those were tattooed, in the afterlife, her legs would actually become gangrenous, and she wouldn't be able to meet her ancestors on the other side. Now, let me just show you, this is only 50 seconds. Some people are sometimes disturbed by it. It's a little noisy, but it's really old historic footage from 1950. It's not great quality, and the narration is in Dutch, but I just wanted to show you sort of how these tattoos were created amongst the Kayan. So basically, a wood stencil was carved by a man, and then it was impressed on the skin, and then a female tattooist, invariably, it was always a female tattooist amongst the Kayan, who would apply the markings to the skin. And it's interesting that these women were considered to be sort of like priestesses in the sense that they worked under tutelary spirits. There were two tutelary spirits. If you were a woman of the highest, the aristocratic class, you prayed to the highest of these tutelary spirits, and her daughter was believed to be the protector spirit of all of the common women that were tattooed. And I don't want to go into all the different rituals and chants that took place before the tattoos are actually created, but this will give you sort of an idea of the process. And hold on a second. Let's see if we get this to work. This is a very young woman, maybe 14, 15 years old.
Hier kun je zo hard huilen als je wilt. Er zal toch niemand komen helpen. Dit is een dorp op Borneo, 15 dagen van de kust.
Ultimately, what he's saying is, more or less, that even though her cries can be heard 500 miles away on the coast, the tattooist is so unmoved she continues with her work.
And the vrouw zegt men op Borneo.
It's very serious about
hoe meer hier een meisje in haar jeugd moet gillen, hoe meer succes ze later zal hebben bij de mannen van haar stam, die alleen maar oog hebben voor vrouwen met een geschonden huid. Een voorwaarde die onze vrouwen nooit zullen.
They also used to file down their teeth for beautification. You could just see a little glimpse of that. So hand tapping, that's one of the more ancient techniques in the world. But we think that skin cut tattooing, it's sort of like a form of scar tattooing, where an incision is made and then the pigment is vigorously rubbed in, is much more ancient. There is evidence that the ancestors of the Ainu, the Homon people of northern Japan and Hokkaido, actually practiced tattooing, and that there was an unbroken chain of sort of body modification amongst those groups down through the Ainu up until 1998 when the last one with traditional facial tattooing passed away. But it also occurs in certain regions of Africa, especially in higher elevations, plateau regions, like the Makande of Mozambique, and then also Native American tribes in California. So the Miwok, the Yuki, they also practice this form of sort of skin cut scarification tattooing. Skin stitching is a technique I'm getting ready to show you some footage of that was done on my thigh. So it's sort of, I guess you could say it's a performance piece, but it's pretty short. For 2,500 years, it was the method of basically applying tattoos across the Arctic. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, it died out more or less around 2010 with the last woman who wore skin stitch tattoos on her face and her body. But it also occurred in other regions, amongst the pre-Columbian Chimu of Peru and northern Chile. Northern Chile. They also there's evidence that they also practiced this form of tattooing in some occasions. But basically how it works is that you pick up a fold of skin, you have a needle that is attached to sinew, a thread. The thread is impregnated with pigment, and as you enter and exit the skin, it'll leave a dot on either side. So there's a dot in the entrance and a dot on the exit. And you go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and you can only create very simple geometric patterns. You can't do photorealism or anything like that they produce today, you know, in a tattoo shop. But over time, it's interesting because this tattoo sort of moves. And so the skin, the pigment under the skin that's typically dot-like when it's first applied, it starts to spread and get thick. So over time, it becomes linear. So it's kind of an interesting tattoo that's sort of always moving and transforming itself. But today, there's really only one expert in this technique. And like all great tattoo artists, in order to master this technique, he experimented on himself. And his name's Colin Dale, and he works in Copenhagen, Denmark. He's actually was born in Canada, in Saskatchewan. But he's pretty much at the forefront of this tattooing technique. He doesn't get many clients, as you can imagine, because it's very painful, and it's very time-consuming. It takes a lot of time to create just, you know, a few of these. These are whale fluke tails, and this is my thigh, actually. But that probably represents maybe 30 minutes of tattooing right there. Just those fluke tails. Not the lines, those are from somewhere else, but just those tiny little fluke tails. But I have about 6 hours of fluke tails on my upper thigh. But we like to give cultural demonstrations at tattoo conventions, usually in Europe, just to sort of demonstrate these ancient techniques, sort of breathe life into them, just so people get a sense of how it was done, what it looks like, what it might feel like. And so whenever we get the chance, we try to do it. And this is a quick clip. And I really apologize, but there's a really bad Italian Neil Young cover band in the background playing. And I can't tell you that. Oops, whoops, we lost something there. Hold on a minute. Where do we go? And I'm sorry about the quality of the footage, because I was actually shooting this on myself, so I was craning my neck over my thigh. So it's not for everybody. I mean, tattoos aren't for everybody. I mean, I wouldn't want everybody to go get a tattoo. It's a serious and permanent commitment the rest of your life, unless you get it lasered off. But obviously, think before you ink is the old maxim. We've talked a little bit about the religious nature of certain tattoos. I kind of want to go closer to home, where I started my research, and I know a lot about it there and other places too. I've written a few books over there for if you'd like to review those. But there's some interesting tattoos that I call tattoo foils that were used in amongst Arctic peoples, and there are also ones that increased a woman's fertility, which I've also mentioned that as far as the Cayenne and Sarawak. So I'm just going to sort of run through a couple of these really quickly, and then we move on to some more video, which I think is important because the video is going to feature indigenous peoples talking about why tattoos are important to them, especially from a religious standpoint. So I'd rather have you listen to them than to me, because I think that's much more interesting. But these are sort of tattoo foils that are placed, that used to be placed on the faces of women to sort of disguise the identity of the bearer from the disease-bearing spirits that they believed would enter their domain. They also had these sort of guardian figurines, which I call those guardian tattoos. They're stick-like figurines that were supposed to channel an important and powerful ancestral figure onto the body and into the body, so that to sort of fortify them with a supernatural strength to repel evil spirits. I also think that in many cases, when you have these traditions of sort of trying to disguise your identity or to sort of appropriate the power of an ancestral figure, I think that the reverse could also be said, and that in some sense, I believe that the spirits of disease may also have been tattooed, because throughout the indigenous world, disease-bearing spirits, evil spirits, all were believed to live in villages, like their human counterparts. They ate foods, they had their own activities, their own dances. So I think that they also may have been tattooed. So in this sense, by appropriating the tattoos that were supposed to repel the evil entity, you actually become one with the spirits. So therefore, it recognizes you as a fellow spirit and it leaves you alone. But that's just an idea that I have. But there's also these really beautiful patterns. Again, all these were skin-stitched on the body. They're clan patterns, tribal identifiers. And if you saw the video I just showed, you can think about how much time and how many sittings it would have taken to complete a full arm tattoo via skin stitching. Extremely painful, especially on the face. So we've talked a little bit about hand tapping. These are just some of the other regions around the world where hand tapping was very commonplace. I showed some tools from the Smithsonian. I always like to spotlight certain collections that we have, which are pretty incredible. I'm very lucky to be able to work with those whenever I want to. But there is a really interesting woman who's working in the northern Philippines who's now 94 years old. She's the last master tattooist of her tribe, the Kalinga, and I have a book about it right there. And she's actually featured in that photograph right there closest to me near the floor. She's dedicated her life ultimately to tattooing amongst the Kalinga, and she has passed on this knowledge to a great niece of hers, now 18, and also to another woman in her village. But after we featured her in the Discovery Channel series, which you're getting ready to see a clip, she's become internationally known. People have been trekking to a remote village to receive tattoos from her for many different reasons. I don't want to go into those because everybody's motivated for a different reason why they want to get tattooed. She's received international media attention, and she's become pretty much an icon throughout the Philippines and throughout the tattooing world of what could have been lost in some sense before it was sort of given new legs, if you will, through people taking more interest and, you know, wanting to preserve that information on a global scale. And now she's basically passed on this information to other generations because they felt, the Kalinga themselves felt like they're losing part of their identity and they want it to be preserved. Because it's an important aspect of who they are. And she'll talk about some of the religious aspects of tattooing, and she's actually marking a man.
On my first morning in the village, a warrior arrives from a nearby Kalinga town. His name's Fana, and he's come to see Wang Ad to get a headhunter tattoo, which can only mean one thing. He must have killed someone.
Yeah, it's a warrior culture, and they still have blood feuds that go back 300 years. So they are still retaliating one another for
opportunity to watch a Kalinga tattoo artist at work. And I just can't believe that I'm sitting here watching this right now.
But warfare now is long range. There's no more headhunting.
Recently, Fana killed
everybody
three
has an assault rifle,
his village.
So they can pick
Wang
each other
Ad
off at hundreds of yards.
Wang Ad is tattooing a line on his chest for each of the enemy lives he took. The tattoo getting tapped into Fana's chest is called the Baking. This is the most important tattoo among the Kalinga, as it shows the warrior's bravery to the tribe. Although it's an honor for Fana to get this tattoo, it's also a painful ordeal.
An orange thorn is razor sharp. It's as sharp as a sewing needle. And think about that going in and out of your skin about 100 times a minute. It kind of sends chills up my spine.
Yeah, look at all the blood running out of these lines. I know it really hurts, and every time the orange thorn picks up a fold of his skin, Fana kind of winces in pain.
And before she tattooed, she observed several food
taboos.
Wang Ad
tells me
taboos,
that this ritual is
a
serious religious experience.
Which is very common throughout the indigenous world before a tattoo is given.
And the spirits expect
so
Fana
she refrained
to
from
act
drinking
bravely.
Alcohol. She only took rice, no meat, before the tattoo is given.
They'll inflict death and destruction on the community. I'm in the northern Philippines investigating the disappearing art of Kalinga tattooing from tattoo master Wang Ad.
Manila, nabin matoy dan ohohato ay tagusha bisa unang kigalilian sa tanah bisa
mohohato. It's extremely rare for a woman actually to tattoo amongst this tribe because no one can remember another woman tattooing at all before Wang Ad.
Unless Wang Ad passes on
but her
skills
was a master
to an apprentice,
tattooist.
Fana could be the last
he had many
warrior
children, but
to
she was the only one that took interest,
tattoo.
And so he apprenticed her, and she had natural talents that were cultivated.
When it's complete, Fana's tattoo will resemble the chest of this
and now
warrior
it's interesting because
who earned
tattooists
his marks for the heads he took, fighting against the Japanese in World War II.
Wow, this man is covered in warrior tattoos. See these lines right here? These are the base lines which Fana received. And from there, you can see how ornate and how intricate the tattoo will become once it's completed. All of these different snake scale designs, centipede designs, and then he has these really beautiful geometric lines on both of his forearms. Kalinga tattooing is definitely vanishing. In one more generation, it's gonna be gone forever.
Yeah, there are over 25 to 30 recognized patterns amongst the Kalinga that have their own names. And there are a lot of spiritual aspects to them related to their traditional animistic religion, and they're all in my book. I mean, I could go on and talk about them, but I don't have time. This is another technique which I can only describe as sort of a form of hand hammering. So it's used, this particular Naga tribe, not all of the Naga groups, but other Naga hand tap, just like we saw with the Kalinga. But they create like ads, more or less, and they hammer the tattoos into the skin. Basically, missionization, especially American Baptist missionaries that arrived in this region a long, long time ago, pretty much forbade or dissuaded the practice. But in a video you're going to see shortly, a young girl decided to take upon herself to sort of rekindle the art form. Because there's really no governmental restriction against it at all, obviously. Everybody's tattooing around the world. But the thing that's sad to me is that a lot of these indigenous groups that we're talking about and we're seeing video from is that the younger generations are very interested in tattoos, but they're interested in the Western-style tattooing, the rock star tattoos, the Rihanna tattoos. They're not interested in their traditional tribal tattoos. And a lot of the elders are seriously upset and saddened by that fact, that they don't value them as much as they should. But there are certain places around the world, there are certain people. I have a Naga friend who is really basically devoting his life to sort of bringing back Naga tattooing, but in a contemporary way. Obviously, you can't wear headhunting tattoos like the Naga used to be headhunters, and you could only earn certain tattoos if you'd killed someone. But trying to recontextualize it in a contemporary way to bring back its meaning so that it continues on into the future. And this is happening in certain places. In other places, it's not, unfortunately. But a lot of the women's tattoos were tribal identifiers, so different clans, even family symbols. And that's an example of that with the leg tattoos right there. So this footage was shot about, 2008. And I can't find my cursor, there we go.
Traveling to Nianu Village requires special permits from the Indian government. Permits that have never before been granted to a foreign camera crew. And now that I'm here, the Queen has invited me to witness a female tattooing ceremony. A ritual that hasn't taken place in many years.
The main reason for the restriction is that there are Naga separatists that want to break away and create their own state. Gandhi actually promised them their own state, but he was assassinated and no one ever picked up the cause. So they're still fighting to this day.
Right now, the Queen is getting ready to stencil the design on her client's legs. This is a really special moment for me, not only because this might be the last Wancho tattoo given to a woman, but I'm really not supposed to be here. All men are supposed to be in the house and forbidden from watching this.
The main reason is because if a man watched it, it's believed that you would have terrible luck in hunting for the rest of your life and in fishing. But since I'm not a Wancho, it was okay.
The tattoos that this girl's about to receive signify that she has become a woman and that she's eligible to be married.
It's customary for the surrounding women to pull the skin taut around the painted stencil so that the Queen can tattoo her lines as clean and fine as possible.
The tattoo queen is going over each stencil two or three times to really sink in the pigment.
And I should mention it, I guess I didn't.
And she's handling it really, really well,
but
she does
with the
have
Wancho,
all of her friends and
all
family members
all tattooing
here
was done by queens, so the aristocrats basically control the commerce in tattooing. And only they could reserve certain patterns for the nobility. So commoners were tattooed, common women were tattooed with different designs.
The blood is starting to flow now, and the tattoo queen has asked one of her assistants to add more pigment to the incisions.
Yeah, and typically she showed her navel tattoos. That's usually the first tattoo that's placed on a girl when she was about 7. And there are different successive stages of tattoos that marks a
she's
significant
really
life
laying
event.
In the
so
tattoos
prior
nicely,
to marriage,
they're very
after
even,
marriage,
they're very
after
neat,
your
they're
first
very
baby,
precise.
You were tattooed with certain symbols to mark those life stages.
Tattooed in over 10 years.
So they're really part of your biography of who you were, who you are.
Oh, thank you.
Sucking on a betel nut, or soli as it's called here, is a popular local tradition. It also offers the queen and her assistants a needed coffee-like kick while turning their mouths red.
Well, it's been about 15 minutes and the tattooing is done.
Charred remains of a local plant are being used to clean her wounds because it's thought to have healing properties.
We always try to identify, you know, these particular plants and find
Depeng
English
has markings on both her legs, but traditionally,
no
she would have had
what
her
they are.
Entire
so I always
shin
wonder
tattooed,
what these medicinal plants,
and that would have taken hours,
that could be
if not an entire day.
Of use in the future to the medical industry, biotech. And I collect them when I can and have them identified, but usually it's not possible, so. You never know, it could be the cure for cancer, that I have no idea, but. Hand poking. This is one of the last techniques I'm going to talk about. There's one other form the Maori practiced, but there's no video footage there because that hasn't been practiced in a long time, over 100 years, and it's pretty much extinct. But hand poking is very prevalent across Southeast Asia, especially Indochina and Thailand, and it's associated typically with a form of Buddhist tattooing that is believed to give the bearer, if they hold their Buddhist precepts, particular abilities and power. So it might give you, you know, incredibly beautiful speech so that when you enter into a business contract, people will just give in to your demands and sign away. Others, like, that are in dangerous, like if they're construction workers or they're a gangster, or they're a taxi cab driver, or they have a dangerous profession, they're believed to, like if you crash into a wall as a taxi cab driver, you could just walk away. Or if you shot with a bullet, it'll go right through you. Or if you're hacked with a knife, then it'll just bounce off your skin. I've had other men that told me, because of the protective power in their tattoos, that they have been in fires working in ship cargoes, like the hold of the ship, and the fire was coming at me, burning oil was everywhere, and it just formed a circle around me and burned until it burned out, and I was not harmed at all because I'm completely protected by the power of my tattoos. And typically the power is believed to come from the Buddha himself, but also the master monks that administer the tattoos, and they typically use a sort of a secret recipe. Sometimes it could even be the exfoliated skin of a master monk. And basically, you add to your protective potential by using these magical pigments. But hand poking also occurred in Native North America. But what's really interesting about these Haida tools is that they resemble miniature Japanese hand poking tools. And we know that there have been relationships between Japan and the Northwest Coast, but Haida is the Queen Charlotte Islands off the coast of Canada, the Northwest Coast. But we don't know if actual sort of this adoption of these types of tools actually came from Japan or if it was an independent development. What was really interesting is that their old word for tattooing is skin stitching, so sewing on the skin. So at one time they did practice skin embroidery, but at some point in time they developed this other technique, which is a lot faster, I can tell you that, to apply a tattoo. It's less painful than being skin stitched. So it might not have been such a huge practical leap to do it. So maybe independent invention, maybe not. We don't know. But I want to show you sort of some footage from a tattooing session taking place at Wat Ben Pra, which is one of the most famous Thai Buddhist monasteries, where there's actually a tattoo festival that takes place every year, the first weekend of March. And the power of the tattoos is overwhelming to some, as you will see here in this video excerpt. And I just want to pass through that really quick because they'll speak to that in a minute.
Luang Pinan is a master tattooist. His tattoos are believed to be among the most powerful in Thailand. It would be an honor for me to get a tattoo from him. But if Luang Pinan doesn't think you're ready for a magic tattoo, he'll turn you away.
So what this monk is doing is that he uses a stencil, he imprints a design, and then he uses a lot of wrist action, real rapid wrist action, to make the tattoos. Now this guy, he just put two tattoos on either side of the shoulder blade. You can see how fine the lines are. There's
again, these really dot-like tattoos, and over time,
he's
spread,
a little bit, but he's healing up nicely. Linear. But these are all sacred prayers. They're protective tattoos.
People were telling me that this monk was the most powerful tattooing monk in Wat Ben Phra. I was really surprised because he didn't have any visible tattoos. And I just assumed, you know, you had to have a lot of tattoos to become more powerful. But then I later learned that he wears a lot of invisible tattoos, and the most powerful tattoos are actually those that are not pigmented. And they're made out of sort of an invisible ink, if you will, of coconut milk and different herbs and
warriors to shield them in battle.
Things that basically have no trace. So he's covered in
when
tattoos, it's just they're not visible.
When Monk finishes a tattoo, he blows on it, transferring his spiritual energy into the tattoo, making it magical. Sometimes these sacred forces can overcome the person, sending him into a wild trance.
See, I think he was possessed by some kind of magic in the tattoo, and he just kind of went off.
I've never seen a tattoo have such an effect on someone.
But again, for a person like me to get a tattoo like that, which I do have one from that monk, is really, it has no magical power whatsoever, because I'm not a Buddhist.
One
so
of them is
for me, it's mainly a souvenir.
He's an elephant trainer,
but it's the power of belief—the power of belief which gives it.
His job's a dangerous one, so he's getting a tattoo to protect himself. Two assistants are needed. I volunteer so I can get a closer look at the master's work.
This is the tattoo stencil that the monk's applying to his neck right now, and he's going to use that as his guide.
Luang Pinan has read Pan's aura and decides to give him a nine-spire temple tattoo, a symbol so powerful it can protect you from death.
It's basically a symbol that protects you from all of the cardinal subordinate directions.
The power of the magic tattoo has now entered Pan's body.
But the real power is in that script that was placed at the very bottom. That's not stenciled, that's all in memory. So these monks, the master monks, memorize all of these sort of sacred spells and they write them in this special calligraphy. And that's really the most powerful aspect of the tattoo, other than the fact that the pigment could contain some extraordinary properties. Just briefly going to mention, this is the last technique that's known in the indigenous world to have occurred at one point in time. So it was sort of a form of Maori skin carving. So they used these chisels and actually carved grooves in the face, and then the ink, which was often passed down from father to son and stored in these really amazing vessels, was rubbed into the wounds. And because it was so painful and there was so much swelling that you could not basically swallow on your own, these really immaculate feeding tubes were given to those individuals so that they could actually take in a liquid diet until they healed. I look at each one of these individuals as sort of like their bodies as a World Heritage Site. Just like we protect the pyramids, the Great Wall, I think we need to preserve the knowledge that's embodied in these tattoos for future generations. I think that someone could do a much better job than I can do, especially if I was a local person who spoke these tribal languages, because I usually have to work through a translator or a guide. But typically, you know, I use my networks and I find an anthropologist who's worked in these regions for 20 or 30 years so that I can get those contacts. So it's not a perfect world, but I try my best. And you must always write your grants and, you know, get funds for the field. But the backstory to this video footage you're getting ready to see, it was one of the most amazing experiences I ever had, and it was in 2002 on the Skrung River in Sarawak, which is Malaysian Borneo. And I was there on a National Geographic film shoot for a pilot project called The Vanishing Tattoo, and I was not the host, I was the still photographer. And what happened is that Mong was the last tattooist and designer from this river system, and he was a World War II veteran. And they fought the Japanese with just blowguns and spears and swords against heavy machine guns and grenades and flamethrowers. But he created these magical tattoos because of the tutelary spirit that taught him to tattoo through dreams and through visions. And this spirit told him when he was a young man starting out to cut open a particular tree in the jungle and you'll find a special object that you should use as an amulet and dip it in every batch of tattooing pigment you make, because it will give those bearers of your tattoos magical powers. And in this case, he will talk about how the bullets went through people and around people, and of the 55 Ebon Rangers that fought against the Japanese in World War II, of which he was one, all of them but one came back unharmed, uninjured to the Strong. And I said, they fought against, you know, overwhelming odds. And the story goes that the one guy that didn't come back, he married a beautiful Malaysian woman, had a huge family, and lived in Kuala Lumpur, and was a very successful businessman. So I don't know if that's true. It was really an incredible story, because he was basically on his deathbed when we arrived at the river, and I was traveling with two of his young relatives, who are now tattooists in their own right in Kuala Lumpur, and they're fantastic tattooists, and they're both Ebon. Anyway, he was dying of cancer at the time, and as soon as we set foot on the river system, we heard that, you know, you need to go visit him immediately, because any moment he could pass away. But the film crew had other ideas, and they're like, we're not scheduled to go there for 5 days, so, you know, I'm sure he's going to wait for us, right? There's no way he's going to pass away. So anyway, in the middle of the night, first longhouse we visited, we took off in the middle of the night because they didn't need us, and we captured this amazing interview. And we had a really crappy HD camera with one stark bulb that sort of cast this eerie halo around Hmong as he told us this incredible story that my friends told me. He told us things he'd never told them before, and they'd interviewed him many times, because they are, after all, his relatives.
Hmong's been bedridden for 5 days, yet he's risen specially to greet his visitors. Lars has seen many subjects of his research die before they passed on their knowledge, so wisely, he takes the attitude that there's no tomorrow. He appears to bask in the eerie limelight cast by one stark bulb in Simon's home movie camera, and by Lars Krutak's professional curiosity.
The person who gave tattoo a long time ago, was that the real expert tattoo artist? Was that a hereditary position, or could anybody do it?
It's a communal thing, and everybody is involved.
Anybody can do it.
But as we got deeper in the conversation, he said really the masters were the ones who gained a guardian or a tutelary spirit, and they became the most famous tattooists. So anybody could do it, but the masters were the ones that had this sort of spiritual mentor.
Like Akibosai, Hmong was an Ebon Ranger,
and he told us about this charmed amulet,
which they'd never heard about before.
He's showing the bullets going around and through them.
Japan,
machine gun. Ask him if he thinks that.
Lars has heard that tattoos also play a role in the afterlife. Hmong begins to speak of Mundai, the river that runs through Sebeong, the land of the dead. Departed souls must venture up this treacherous river, hoping to reach the longhouses of their most heroic ancestors. But legend has it that this is a journey only the most heavily tattooed Ebon can complete. If that's true, Hmong must be making good time through Sebeong, because incredibly, that night, the old man dies in his sleep.
So yeah, we're really fortunate. We got there just the right time. When we first showed up at the longhouse, he was laying on the floor, basically covered on a blanket. All of his female relatives are surrounding him, waiting for him to die. His bodily functions weren't working. But he got up, he was energized, and gave us this amazing 3-hour interview. And then as we went to bed later that night, this huge thunderstorm came out of nowhere, and it was the dry season, although it could rain any day there, even if it's the dry season. And lightning was crashing all around us, shaking the foundations of the longhouse. And then the next morning, somebody came in, a woman from the night before, and she said he passed away in his sleep. So we think that he was saving some of this information for a special visitor, and we just happened to get there at the right time. And this charmed amulet, can anybody guess what it possibly could have been? It's extraterrestrial. It was a meteorite. And it existed. It wasn't a story. This is the last example that I'm going to talk about, and then we're just going to open up the floor to discussion and questions from the audience. But the Mentawai, I don't know if any of you have heard of the Mentawai, but they live on a really remote island called Sybarat off the coast of Sumatra. We believe that their tattooing traditions have lasted or have gone back at least to 3,500 years old. They're 3,500 years old. And it's sort of walking into a time capsule there because they still manufacture their clothing from bark cloth. They don't really have many trappings of modernity, I mean, aside from transistor radios and the occasional cow. They pretty much, and some fancy jewelry, but they seemingly live sort of like in this time capsule in the middle of the jungle, of a really remote place to get to, and it took us 4 days to get there from Washington, D.C., and we basically had to build a camp, our own village in the middle of the jungle, to film there. And I think that's why no other film crew had spent so much time or even attempted it, because of the expense and the unpredictability of the weather. I mean, there really is no dry season. It's the rainforest, and it rains and rains and rains and rains, and that's really hard to shoot in a place like that. But in a nutshell, they believe that tattoos and other forms of beautification, like beaded headbands, feathers, beads, put their bodily souls in harmony with the spirits of the cosmos, because the spirits govern everything that they do, from the foods that they harvest, from the monkeys they hunt. If they can please the souls in their body and please the spirits that govern the cosmos, that's a really good thing. It keeps everything in harmony. And so ultimately, their tattoos are just another form of beautification that keep everything in balance. And that's why tattoos are so important to them. But they're also important from the concept of identity, which they'll speak about in a second. The other interesting thing about the Mentawai is that only shamans give the tattoos. But they also have protective tattoos. These rosettes on the shoulders.
It's day 5 here in Sybarat Island, and I just found out that Aman Lao Lao's brother-in-law, Amani Pai, is preparing for his next Mentawai tattoo. It's believed that the Mentawaians started tattooing their bodies around 1500 BC, making it one of the world's oldest living traditions. Today, master tattooist Aman Barita arrives to continue this ritual.
Amani Pai is going to get his fourth stage of Mentawai tattooing. It's going to consist of a series of lines and curves that extend up both thighs around to his buttocks.
All Mentawaians are considered to be equals, so even though Amani Pai is a common person, or simatok, his tattoos will be identical to the tattoos of the shaman.
I can tell Aman Barita is an expert technician. He's laying these lines perfectly down on Amani Pai's leg. How do you feel, Amani Pai? Are you ready to get your tattoo?
Tub marod. Huh? What tub marod na kulepa?
Although Aman Barita is using a brass nail instead of the traditional lemon thorn, he still has to go over each area twice to make these lines bold and beautiful.
I can only imagine how bad it hurts getting tattooed on the kneecap. It's all bone right there. Is there a difference in the tattooing traditions of Amani Pai's generation and Aman Telephon's generation?
Amani Pai, amate wadnia titi natenan. Amate wadnia shimatao, shimahayo. Mahayo wadnia tu unanan. Amale vira dnia fixarina.
So it sounds like it's important for you to get some tattoos.
Yes, there's a generational rift that's going on right now with the Mentawai.
Just then, Aman Barita announces that the tattoo is complete.
Whenever they go down to the coast to trade, they
Now Mama Lao is going to take him down to the river and heal these
about their tattoos. He doesn't have any tattoos because he doesn't want to be ostracized and being heckled by
there is always a health risk when getting a tattoo
that live
of
on the coast. So typically when mental mind women that are tattooed go down the coast, they cover up all their tattoos with long sleeves and pants. In check. So that's one of the reasons why the younger generations are not getting tattooed. But his father is very upset because how could you possibly be a real mental white shaman without tattoos? The spirits won't even recognize you as a shaman if you don't have tattoos, because they're also tattooed. So it's a big problem. But I am happy to report that 2 years ago, Amani Pai did receive, or Montelephon received his full complement of tattoos. So his father's very happy now. So this is just one of my new projects. It's actually a book that's coming out June 16th. But more or less, it focuses on the history, the untold history of Native North American tattooing. Surprisingly, there is not one book on the subject. So it's taken 17 years of putting together information, conducting numerous interviews with people who have brought it back in recent decades. So there are representatives of at least 15 First Nations and Native North American tribes that tell their deeply biographical stories of why they wanted to bring back their tattoos and what the meanings are behind those tattoos and what it will hold for future generations. But it should be released on June 16th, and I will be promoting it shortly at the Toronto Tattoo Convention, which is the, sort of the international launch on June 12th. But if you have any questions, we can hold those after the discussion. I also have a few of my books if you reviewed them there. I also have a few copies for purchase if you're interested, but you can talk to me after we finish the presentation. With that said, I don't really have anything else. If you want to follow up on some of these revitalization movements, you can please visit my friends' websites. And I'm always constantly posting updates on different tattoo events and things happening around the tattoo world on my website and also my Facebook pages. So with that said, thank you very much.
Lars, thank you.
Sure.
I'm not sure this works. It works, yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. This was really fascinating, and actually this gave at least me and everybody else, I suppose, the opportunity to think a lot about what is going on with tattoos nowadays as well. So let me start with the most basic question I can think of. Tattoo, as we saw it in your presentation, was, let's say, the most common version of body modification, right? Why on the skin? Why should this happen on the surface? What is so important about this specific place where tattoo is inscribed? Why not something else? Something deep, deep inside the body? Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for that question. It's a good question. As you can see through all the videos I showed, most of these people live in very warm tropical climates, but not necessarily the case in the Arctic. But oftentimes, almost all these cultures had a tradition of facial tattooing. And obviously the first thing that we see when we meet a person from our culture or from a different culture is your face. And obviously when you're putting tribal marks on your face or marks of honor like if you've earned in warfare or in hunting, that's the first place we look to before we make our impression about somebody. And it's basically a billboard for all of our life's accomplishments. And it talks a lot about, well, I think because it's basically a palimpsest. I mean, it's basically a book cover, if you will, and it tells the stories of one's biography.
Okay, then let me, as you talked about a biography, let me go back to this case of the warrior who had this tattoo because he had already killed someone. To me, this was the most obvious case of a relationship between tattoo and memory. In a sense, something that reminding him and everyone else about something that had already happened. On most, in most other cases, one could see a function of tattoo that doesn't so much have to do with memory, but a tattoo that has to perform, that will be performing something, like keeping death away or something like that.
Or fertility, right? Yeah, performing a function.
Whereas nowadays, tattoos are, in most cases, souvenirs or have this function as well. It is a quite an obvious function. I have a heart on my, I don't know, on my chest because I loved someone. things like that. So what is, let's say, the dialectics between tattoo and memory in most of these cases? I don't know. I do know that it is not just one case. It's not always the same function. But what could you tell us about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think cross-culturally with the indigenous people and contemporary tattooers today, this act of commemorating certain life's events, I think, is very common and very similar. You know, be it if you're a warrior, be it if someone you lost a loved one, or you've made a significant achievement. We were just talking about script tattoos earlier, I was with Francois talking about maybe the meanings behind that. There's always a meaning behind tattooing. I mean, even if somebody says, oh, I got drunk one night and I got a tattoo, we just did it for the hell of it. I mean, there is still a thought process that goes on to sort of instill you with going and getting one. But yeah, in the collective memory of things, I mean, it's always something that you can point to and reconnect to a historical event that was significant in your life, and I think that's why these tattoos are permanent. Obviously, you could put body paint on oneself, and you can easily remove that, even semi-permanent body paint, like Jinipapu or Yagua fruit. But in these cases, and the people that I work with, they wanted to commemorate it for eternity. And oftentimes, and I didn't really talk about this here, but I talk about it to some degree in one of the panels there, many indigenous cultures saw their tattoos as the only thing they could take with them to the grave. Mm-hmm. And there was functions that were performed there as well. And I know Russian prisoners, having worked in democratization and monitoring elections in Siberia a long time ago, that they told me that the only thing that they could take with them into prison were their tattoos, because everything else was stripped away. So I think, you know, as something that always will belong with you and stay with you no matter where you go and to the grave. I mean, in some indigenous cultures, they believe that you can actually use your tattoos as currency to buy things in the afterlife. I don't know exactly how that works. But it's pretty significant in permanently marking these events and stating who you are.
Mm-hmm. Then what about the memory of the ritual itself? To what extent are people allowed to reproduce, let's say, the memory of the pain they have been experienced?
Sure.
We saw the lady doing this. We saw the war, the young guy doing this to some extent, but this was just after the fact. How does this happen, if this happens, in some of these cases, a long time after?
Well, as an ancestral tradition, every time that you perform the ritual, you're recreating something in the past, and you're bringing it into the present and hopefully into the future. So it's a continuation of an experience of sort of linear progression, but of historical memory that's being reenacted over and over and over again. And I think that's another reason why it continues. And there's a lot of, I mean, I've been tattooed by all of these different techniques too, and there's a lot of feelings, smells, sensations that are really essential into sort of transforming that person into a new person. It's sort of a rebirth that takes place, if you will. And a lot of people do talk about that. Even for the Native American book, there was a description of when one of the first chin tattoos was received by a Native Californian woman in the last 10 years. They saw like a new person being born in their midst. The blood was released, almost as if a baby was being born in the expiation of blood, and now there was a new person in their midst. But in that case, there's a lot more to that story than just that. All the pain and suffering that their ancestors went through so that they could still live today, so that they could actually bring back this custom, is a whole other story of overcoming that genocide perpetrated by the U.S. government, basically trying to exterminate most of these tribes. Maybe I went off and didn't answer your question directly. But
no, it was a good way of answering it. One more thing, perhaps. You placed...
Oh, you know what I just mentioned? I forgot to mention, sorry. Yeah. I was just in Myanmar, came back 2 weeks ago. And what was really interesting there, that's what I forgot, is that I hadn't encountered this on the Naga side of India. The Naga is a really large ethnic group that spans Arunachal Pradesh, Nagaland, and they spill into the northwestern corner of Myanmar. But I met men there that wanted to preserve the memory of their great ancestors through these really amazing neck tattoos that you could only wear formerly as a warrior or a tiger hunter or tiger killer. Mm-hmm. And I'd never encountered that on the Indian side. And I didn't think it would be allowed, for one, because I thought you had to earn the right. But for whatever reason, they wanted to preserve those memories of their great ancestors, I mean, directly, and that was the reason. It wasn't about, you know, the tradition per se, but just the memories of those famous ancestors, uncles, grandparents.
Okay, thanks. One more thing I was thinking about. You talked about this permanent nature of the tattoo. Let me use, an experience, a very contemporary experience. We see people in their, let's say, 50s or even 60s who had a tattoo back in their early 20s or late 20s when their bodies were young and fit and muscular and everything. And then we see the same tattoos now moving down, you know, in a sense, changing place on their bodies. In these cases, that you know very well, do people think about the aging body, the skin that will be deteriorating in a few years? How do they take this into account?
It's actually interesting. It's more of a counter-argument, specifically with the Kalinga, because the women believe that if you're fortified in full body tattoos, your skin won't become wrinkled, that it'll preserve your flesh. and I've encountered that in a couple other tribes, but I can't think of them, but that's the best example. And that's why all women believe that they retain their beauty, and of course, Wang Ad's quite fetching at 94, because of those tattoos in their body. And I also, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of these women believe that they take their tattoos to the grave, and even their spiritual essence continues to carry these tattoos onwards in the afterlife because they continue to serve certain functions. Either, like, as I said, you could sell them as currency in the afterlife for provisions, or that you're recognizable by your ancestors in the afterlife, because without tattoos in certain cultures, they won't even recognize you, and you will not be able to share in the joys of being reunited with your loved ones. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps one last question, because before we open the discussion, on several occasions we saw you taking a very close look to the tattoos. What about touching them, not even to mention caressing the tattoos? Under what circumstances would this be possible, allowed? Not only to you, to people of the community as well.
You mean like physically touching them?
Exactly.
I mean, not during the fact or immediately thereafter.
Even after the fact.
But afterwards. Uh-huh. There's not really a problem with that, because oftentimes what I find is tattoos are an icebreaker. I don't look like I have many, but my legs are covered and my butt and my back and my biceps, whatever. They're a natural icebreaker. And so when I come into a village, if I don't speak the language, they're like, who the hell are you? And I start interviewing elders, we immediately share one thing. If it's not the culture, it's not the language, we share that we were both tattooed. Maybe different techniques, although I've had all their techniques. But we can immediately identify and start talking about our tattoos, even though it's sign language. Mm-hmm. And we touching and pointing and rubbing, and that happens quite frequently. And I think that goes a really long way, because I'm very serious and interested in what I'm doing. But it's usually not a problem whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It's generally accepted. But I mean, I'm not probing like old grandmothers and things like that. You know? And the interesting thing is that the women, I mean, I didn't show any photos of sort of scantily clad women, but people are extremely proud of their tattoos. And typically they disrobe for me I don't even ask, and because they want to show the full complement of their tattoos and explain all the meanings behind them. Because I just don't think that there's been serious attention given to them in many, many years. A lot of these words that I'm pulling out, because I go in with a lot of research, throwing out old tattooing terms and things, that I get a lot of curious looks, but they really appreciate bringing attention to their tattooing traditions, and it rekindles a lot of memories. You can see that their minds are clicking and working, and we get huge groups of youth listening to their grandparents and reliving these tales and what the meanings, and I think that's one of the most important and satisfying things for me when I'm in these places doing this kind of research.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
So it is time for questions from you. We have a microphone.
Straight to the wine. No.
Okay. Hi. I heard heard you speak about the motivations for some of these tattoos being social status, warriors, things like that. But I wonder if you could speak a little bit about mating rituals and beautification and attracting a mate and the use of tattoo with that.
Sure. So that first example I gave, the oldest evidence of tattooing as cosmetic was a mustache. Now, I presume that was to attract the opposite sex, I think. But who knows? It's just an interesting question to think about. But there are few cross-cultural examples of sort of love charms, or at least tattoos to commemorate a union, let's put it that way. And then one of the biggest myths I find, you find it around the world, you find it in Myanmar, you find it in amongst the Li in China, you find it in Native Californian tribes, is that there were these myths that were invented, I don't know by who, maybe colonial powers or whatever, that facial marking was actually to make the woman, well, facial marking women, to make them ugly, to detract from their beauty, so that they wouldn't be taken by, you know, raiding parties or slave traders because you would destroy their beauty. But I find talking to indigenous elders in those places where these myths have been perpetrated that no, the opposite was to make them more attractive. And a Native Californian woman I've talked to were like, that's the biggest myth that's ever been perpetuated against us, because I know that these guys were extremely attracted to these women. I don't know why these myths were created other than the fact that they probably just didn't ask questions or they couldn't speak the language to ask the functions behind these tattoos, which was common. I think with early ethnographers and anthropologists, those are the sort of the I think it's a very important question, and it was very common as sort of a body modification, sort of to make yourself more attractive, and it just is something that's not talked about so much. I talk a little bit about it in that little white book down there, the Tattooing Arts Tribal Women, certain ethnographic examples.
Okay, well, we have 1, 2, 3 questions.
Yep.
Hi, thank you. I guess I'm a little curious, going back to some of the earliest parts of your discussion about the medicinal tattooing, and the idea is that not just the, I think there's a lot of spiritual medicine that we're talking about throughout the presentation and throughout all these different tribes and techniques. Is it understood how, you know, is there a more firm understanding of how tattooing is medicinal in both its physical and spiritual qualities? And is it both the art of the tattooing itself, but is there an understanding or a supposition that the after effects will also continue to carry on and ail those joint pains or, you know, whatever it is?
Yeah, a lot of those, when I talk about joint tattoos, a lot of these were repeated applications over time. And if you look at the Iceman, for instance, his tattoos are really dark. And my friends actually work at the institute that houses the Iceman and Bolzano, and they agree. They think that there are multiple applications done by someone other than himself, because obviously they're placed on the back of his spine. How could he possibly do that comfortably? And that they're so dark after 5,300 years that there must have been multiple applications. They did a CT scan of his body, and he was racked by arthritis. He had many other complaints. He even had a whipworm infection, and he had an oral dose of charcoal, of soot, in his colon, I believe, because of the medicinal properties of charcoal, which is, we have some biotech people in who could probably talk more about these things that I met earlier. But my understanding is charcoal, obviously, because of the high degree that the vegetable matter had been heated, for the process of adsorption, I believe that it attracts bacterial particles to its surfaces. And the Chinese have been using charcoal poultices, for 3,000 years to relieve joint sprains and body ailments, wrapping around an injured area. And I think these repeated application sites are the tattoos associated with those. Either they marked the areas for reapplication sites, or they actually, because of the pigments that were mixed into them, charcoal being the primary one, had this medicinal effect that people have been utilizing charcoal for so long. I mean, it's also sterile because of the degree it's been heated. But then again, the power of belief behind it. I mean, as we were talking about in Thailand, obviously, if you do not hold those Buddhist precepts and you don't believe in the power of these tattoos, they're ultimately ineffective. I mean, for me, if somebody shoots me right now, I'm sure it's the bull's not going to go through me or around me. It's going to go right into me. But for someone who believes so strongly about this and lives that religion every waking hour throughout the day, throughout the course of his or her life, then perhaps I know it's something altogether different. So I think it really comes down to that, or a combination of all those wrapped into one little bundle.
Yeah. You sort of just spoke to this a little bit, but my question is, I guess, a medical question. Prior to the brass nail that you mentioned there, I didn't catch what was used. My guess, maybe some animal bones, like
It was a lemon thorn. Citrus thorns are really common. I've been tattooed by citrus thorns. Okay. Sorry. And Wang Odd right here, the Kalinga tattooist, she typically uses citrus thorns of a mountain orange tree, very large, in creating her tattoos, especially for men. Uh-huh. But yeah, usually citrus thorns, and sometimes they're changed out because they dull after a time. But that was the main tool.
And of course, along this line, then, about you just mentioned too about sterilization. Like, if they're using the same thorn, won't a thorn burn? Can you heat up a?
Well, in that case, they might have two thorns set aside for one person,
exactly,
and when they
yeah.
finish tattooing that person, then they'll throw it away if they're going to tattoo another person and use a new thorn. But when I get tattooed, I always make sure that there's a new machine, if you will, made. And in some cases, we may have to use an old tattoo applicator. In the case of the Mentawai, when I was there, I had my butt tattooed also sort of in their style. Uh-huh. But in that case, we could not create one in a time-efficient manner. So I carry this medical powder that's used to sterilize medical instruments. And so you have to heat water to a certain temperature, and then you dip them in there for 15 minutes, and then you reuse it. But yeah, it's a big concern. But the biggest thing that I always worry about this in Thailand is that the belief in these monks that make these tattoos is so great that when they're at these giant tattooing festivals, they continue to use the same rods over and over and over again, and they're just dipped in simple alcohol solution. But people believe so much in the power of these tattoos that they could never get hepatitis, they could never get HIV. Uh-huh. And I think there's sort of a problem there.
Has it been documented for that too?
It has not. The government is very quiet about it, and they've never, that I know of, at least they haven't released any kind of public study. But I'm no medical doctor. I don't know if it's possible. I think it is plausible.
Would take precautions too. When they would clean the site. And then I was also asking about like an infection. Were there some natural remedies like eucalyptus or aloe vera that they use to keep the wound clean? Or also if it's an infection, maybe treat the infection and that sort of thing.
Well, I have come across people that have used medicinal substances to treat the wounds, especially infections, but I've also seen infections resulting in terrible scarification in the same regions where these medicinal substances were applied. So from that standpoint, there are such things, but oftentimes there's no English equivalent to like the flower, the bush. So I try to identify them. In Myanmar, there was two or three substances that they're just like, there's no word in Burmese, there's no word in Nagamese that we can identify. It's just this local tree in this particular tribal language, and that's. So I try to take photographs, I try to take samples, and eventually get them ID'd, but I'm usually not very successful. Well, I know one of the points they're trying to hammer home at the Kwe Brun Lee exhibition is how tattoo has evolved into a fine art, and how there are many top-notch artists, and people want to collect them just like a Dali or a Monet and put them on their bodies. But then again, in the indigenous world, I know through writing my recent book, Native North America, and this applies to many of the indigenous cultures, that there oftentimes is no word, or the person who applies the tattoo is never called a tattoo artist or even an artist. It was never applied for artistry. It had a function and a meaning, and that was pretty much it. But the meaning was not art. It was sometimes for beautification, but that's actually not very common, to tell you the truth. So I do agree with you, at least in the indigenous world, and maybe cross-culturally. I mean, I don't feel like I'm any kind of an artist, although you're calling me one tonight. And again, I'm going to go back to sort of something I just wrote, the Native American book. I mentioned this fact that, you know, basically there were no words for tattoo artists in most of these cultures. But I appreciate what I consider to be the artistry that they created in human bodies. Because I do look at a lot of this. I mean, obviously, there's symmetry involved. There's thought process. Some of the tattoo artists in Alaska did treat their subjects as working on a piece of marble, basically. They wanted to create masterworks that would live on beyond their lifespans and into the future. Although, again, even in that particular culture, there was no word or describing the person who creates tattoos as an artist, per se. There might not even have been a word for artist at all. But I think there's a lot of value in tattooing as an art form, removed apart from its traditional and indigenous meanings, just something as, you know, something that's experiential, something that can be felt. It's intangible in some sense, though, because you can see it, you feel like you can grasp it, you can touch it, but it doesn't have texture always, unless it's like a skin cut tattoo. It sort of fits in an interesting niche of sort of how do we define art, what is art, what is not art, and are non-pigmented tattoos considered to be art, even though they might be applied as masterworks? I don't know either. That's another question, I guess, to think about. Especially the monk that we mentioned before. I mentioned he has these invisible tattoos that you can't even see. But if they were pigmented, his body would be incredibly beautiful, just like some of the monks that are on the back wall there. But we have no idea because we cannot touch it. We cannot grab it. We can't see it. We cannot visualize it. We cannot conceptualize it. So it brings up a lot of really interesting theoretical questions, imagining what is and what is not.
Is there a last short question for Lars? A last short question.
I came in late, so sorry if you already enumerated on this, but I was curious what the importance of the Buddhist tattoos for the monk were.
Yeah, so we did a video piece about that. It can mean many different things to different Buddhist people, but oftentimes they have protective powers, but it goes back to the power of belief and also the person who creates those tattoos. The power of belief, the power of the tattoo is believed to have passed down from the Buddha himself to the monk mentors that he passed his knowledge on to the monks that apply the tattoos. And oftentimes even the skin of revered monks that were tattooing monks will be mixed into this sort of magical pigment, if you will, and be applied to the client depending on how the monk reads their aura and what they believe they need for their line of work. I mean, there's a brief interview period that goes on. But typically those tattoos are given in stages. So there's one that almost everyone receives on the back of their neck. But then again, it also depends on which temple, because some temples have their own tattoos that no other temple has. But more or less, it's a lot about protective magic and empowerment, in a nutshell, without going back into details.